Father, I come before you this evening. I thank you for this opportunity to teach your word. I pray you'd be glorified in all that is said and done. In Christ's name I pray. Amen. So this, according to my calculations, is our 61st week in Genesis. And so we started working through Genesis in our neighborhood fellowships. We started doing that in July of 2018. So just about 2 years ago exactly, and over the course of the past 2 years, we did, I think, 40-something weeks in our neighborhood fellowships, and then now we've done just under 20 on this format. Well, we've done some of them. We were doing it Sunday night, and then we moved to Wednesday, and now we're finally about to finish Genesis up. And then next week, Pastor John is going to finish his Tempted and Tried series that he's been on for a while. And then the week after that, I'm going to do a final review, and that'll be our last lesson in Genesis. And Sunday, we're doing a final wrap-up on 1 John. So this is like the season in which all the series get finished, and we launch into new and exciting endeavors. So that's exciting for me. So after the creational prologue, Genesis is divided into 10 toledot to generations heading, and the, pardon me, the next time that we're in Genesis, we'll be reviewing the book as a whole one last time. And so we're not going to spend as much time on introduction now, because in 2 weeks, we're going to spend a whole week sort of giving a final recap in hopes of getting all the way through Genesis 50 tonight. We'll be briefer than we normally are on the introduction. So you have the prologue, the origins of the world, and then you have 5 toledot or generations headings on the origins of the nations. And then you have 5 toledot or generations headings on the origins of Israel. And so last week, or 2 weeks ago rather, we finally finished the Testament of Jacob in Genesis 49. And tonight we're going to attempt to make it all the way through chapter 50 in one night. So hold on, fasten your seatbelts. We're going to be moving, hopefully, relatively quickly. And it's the last section of the generations of Jacob, which is the 10th and final section of the 10 toledot of Genesis. Pardon me. Genesis 50 can be divided into 3 basic sections. So you have verses 1 through 14. Jacob is mourned and buried. So Jacob dies at the end of chapter 49, and you have the story of the burial of Jacob. And then you have the final parting of Joseph and his brothers. And that really is where we're going to spend our time, because that provides, I think, a crucial key that helps us to see what the story of Joseph as a whole means. And then you have Joseph's own passing in 22 through 26. So 26 verses, 3 sections, and let's launch into it. Chapter 50 and verse 1. Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him and kissed him. In chapter 49, related the passing of Jacob and Joseph's present at Joseph's presence at the passing of Jacob fulfills the divine promise to Jacob that's found in Genesis 46. I will go down with thee. This is God speaking to Jacob. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. That's a promise that when Jacob dies, Joseph is going to be there to take care of Jacob's body after death. It's sort of a metaphor, not a metaphor, but an idiom for Joseph is going to be there when you die. And indeed, just like God promised, Joseph was. And then we find verses 2 and 3. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. And the physicians embalmed Israel. And 40 days were fulfilled for him. For so are fulfilled the days of those which are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Jacob and Joseph are the only people in the whole Old Testament that are said to be embalmed. So the word that is used here is found only in Genesis 50 in verse 2. And then verse 2, 3, and later in verse 26. While this was standard custom in Egypt, it was not so in the land of Israel. So in the land of Israel, you would prepare a body for burial and then you just bury it. But in the land of Egypt, they had, what we know is the mummies. So basically, Jacob is mummified in Egypt. And Joseph will later be mummified as well. And this was necessary because Jacob wanted to be buried in Canaan. So even though Jacob wanted to be buried in Canaan, he wanted to be buried like his family buried, but because he died in Egypt, it was only if something was done to preserve the body that burying burying him in Canaan would be a possibility, because it was a long journey on foot and on horseback. They didn't have, you know, dry ice or anything like that to keep the body cold. If they didn't mummify him, then he wouldn't be able to make it to Canaan without a great stink. And so Jacob was embalmed. And you have these two sequence of days. You have 40 days for the embalming and 70 days for mourning. It's not quite clear whether we should see these as consecutive. So first there's 40 days, then there's 70 more days, or whether we should see them as taking place at the same time. So there's 70 days, 40 of which were taken for the embalming and 30 more for additional mourning. I think the latter is more likely. It's more likely that the 70 days includes the 40 days, but it's not completely clear. Verse 4, and when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spake unto the house of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found grace in your eyes, speak, I pray you, in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, lo, I die in my grave, which I have digged for me in the land of Canaan. There shalt thou bury me. Now therefore, let me go up, I pray thee, and bury my father, and I will come. It's somewhat curious. Joseph spake unto the household of Pharaoh. Why didn't Joseph go to Pharaoh directly? Well, the text doesn't tell us. It may be that it was a mourning custom, that because Joseph had been mourning his father and had been involved with this dead body, that he couldn't go in that condition, and maybe in mourning clothes, you weren't allowed in the house of Pharaoh. That's possible. And that probably is the explanation. It's also possible that this is a different Pharaoh. It, after all, has been almost 30 years since Joseph first rose to power. Not quite 30 years, but Jacob's has been in Egypt for 17 years after he died. And then there were first the 7 years of prosperity before that, and the first couple of years of famine. So it's been almost 30 years since Joseph's first rise to power. So it's entirely conceivable that this is maybe a different Pharaoh, still kindly disposed to Jacob and to Joseph and to their family, but maybe not quite as close. So it's possible he just can't go to the house of Pharaoh himself because of a mourning custom. It's also possible that it's hinting that the great closeness that Joseph once had with Pharaoh is starting to fade. But it's difficult to be certain on that point. In verse 5, he says, my father made me to swear. And so if you go back to Genesis 47 and verse 28, that's where you find the oath that Jacob made Joseph swear. So Genesis 47 and verse 28, and Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. And the time drew nigh that Israel must die, and he called his son Joseph and said unto him, if now I have found grace in thy sight, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and deal kindly with me, and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt, but I will lie with my fathers, and thou shalt carry me out of Egypt, and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will do as thou hast said. And he said, swear unto me, and he sware unto him. And Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. And so what Jacob actually caused Joseph to swear is, don't bury me in the land of Egypt. I don't want to be buried in Egypt, Joseph. Bury me in Canaan instead. But listen to what Joseph says to Pharaoh. My father made me swear, saying, lo, I die in my grave, which I have digged for me in the land of Canaan. There shalt thou bury me. And so Joseph is very careful in his presentation to avoid saying anything that would needlessly offend Pharaoh. He's not distorting the truth. He's not saying something his father didn't say, but he's leaving out those bits of his father's oath that would maybe have a negative effect on, would sound negative to Pharaoh. So whereas Jacob had focused on the negative, don't bury me in Egypt, Joseph, don't bury me in Egypt, Jacob sort of translates that to Pharaoh as, bury me in the grave that I digged, which, since it was a natural cave, perhaps the sense would be that he'd prepared it, or he'd prepared a place for his body within that cave, because obviously he didn't dig the cave himself. It was already there when Abraham bought it. And so he sort of took out anything that would be offensive to Pharaoh or would get in the way of the request being met, and then he presented it in that abbreviated way, and Pharaoh readily agreed. Verse 6, Pharaoh said, go up and bury thy father according as he made thee swear. And then we have verse 7. So he's gotten permission to leave Egypt and go bury his father. And Joseph went up to bury his father. And with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the house of Joseph and his brethren, and his father's house, only their little ones and their flocks and their herds, they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. Does anyone know where the terms little ones, flocks, and herds all together show up again next? That sound familiar to anyone? Janine's raising her hand, I think.
When they left Egypt to go back.
Right. When they left Egypt to go back. So you remember, Pharaoh, at the time of the Exodus, one of the deals that he made with them is, hey, you can go to the land, you can go 3 days' journey, but leave your cattle and leave your little ones behind. So he wasn't willing for them to migrate, but he was willing for them to take a trip. So a future Pharaoh would be willing to let them go without these, but not with them. The cattle and the children made the difference between a permanent move and a temporary trip. And so there's a number of allusions to the Exodus story in this story of the burial of Jacob. Another one of those allusions, we're not going to cover them all, is the chariots and horsemen. The next time chariots and horsemen show up, they're chasing the children of Israel along with their flocks, herds, and little ones across the wilderness. So the attitude is different, but all other references to chariots and horsemen in the Pentateuch refer to chariots and horsemen chasing the children of Israel. So this is the only sort of positive reference to chariots and horsemen, but it's making. Remember, this is addressed to those who have been chased by these chariots and horsemen. So when they're hearing of Pharaoh's chariots and horsemen, they're thinking, wow, this was a lot different from that other time when they went along the same journey, and only this time they were pursuing us instead of helping us bury Jacob. And so there's just a number of those sort of subtle allusions, and that gets picked up in Exodus 14, and Exodus 15 as that story is told. So they all set out without flocks and children and with chariots and horsemen, and we have verse 10. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, pardon me, which is beyond Jordan, and there they mourned with a great and very sore lamentation. And he made a mourning for his father 7 days, and when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning in the floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning to the Egyptians. Wherefore the name of it was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond Jordan. So the location of the threshing floor of Atad, Atad means bramble, so it's the threshing floor of the brambles. The location of this is difficult because the meaning beyond Jordan is entirely dependent on one's perspective. So if you're standing on the east bank of Jordan, then beyond Jordan is in Canaan on the western side. If you're standing in Canaan, then beyond Jordan is on the eastern side. So what is beyond Jordan depends on where you are, and the text doesn't tell us that. But wherever it is, it seems to be somewhere that is visible from Canaan because the Canaanites comment on what they see. They see the Egyptians mourning, and they comment on it. But it seems likely not to be in Canaan proper, because when you get to verse 13, it seems that Jacob's sons are the only ones who enter Canaan with Jacob. So it's somewhere on the border of Canaan. And depending on the location of the site, it's possible that the journey of Jacob mirrors the later journey of the children of Israel into Canaan. So at least one possible location for this threshing floor is on the eastern side of the Jordan River. And so the children of Israel are prefiguring the journey they will later take at the Exodus. And that depends on where it is. And it may be that it's deliberately ambiguous so they can see that echo, even though it may have been somewhere different. So maybe it's using some of the similar language to the story of their journey after the Exodus, even though it may be deliberately ambiguous to help us think of those two things and think of them together. We have the comment of the Canaanites. This is a grievous mourning to the Egyptians. Wherefore, the name of it was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond Jordan. And so Mizraim is simply the Hebrew word for Egypt. So it's the standard word for Egypt. So you have Abel of Egypt, and the word for mourning is the same as a word for brook that's used in place names. So, you know, all the places that are like, you know, Brooktown, Brookfield, or, you know, like field or brook in English place names, that there are many places. So Springfield is one of the most common of all place names in English, because you've got a spring and a field, and it's worthy of pointing out to others. And so it tends to be a real common place name. Well, this word Abel is a word that's used in place names. It's used in like 7 or 8 different place names throughout the Old Testament that refers to a sort of a brook. But it's also the same word that's used for mourning. So it's the same word that's used for mourning in this verse. And so the Canaanites are making a play on words. This is both the brook of the Egyptians and the mourning of the Egyptians. Potentially, there may already have been a brook there, or it's also possible that the stream was the stream of tears from the mourning that was taking place. So Threshing Floor of Atad, that's a place name, and that's what I was saying. We don't know where it is. So it's a location that we're not certain of. So it's a geographical name. And the word Atad has something to do with brambles, but that is just what it was named. So there's no, I don't think, significance to the brambles there. That's just the place name. Did that answer the question?
I was just asking because it says that they saw the mourning in the floor. And I'm like, what would be the significance of looking at that? And it's not to take you off of where you're at. I'm reading it as you're going.
Oh, yeah.
They saw the mourning in the floor of Atad. I'm like, I get Atad as a place, but saw the mourning in the floor. What's the significance of that?
Threshing floor. That's all I... it's possible. Well, threshing floor would be like a hard... So this might actually be really interesting, actually, that you brought this up. So a threshing floor would be like either a really hard flat area or potentially like a stone floor. So it's possible they were weeping and tears were running over the threshing floor and making streams. So that probably is the image that's being portrayed. So that's probably what's going taking place there. And so then we get the actual burial, verse 12 and 13. And his sons did unto him according as he commanded them. For his sons carried him into the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah, which Abraham bought with the field for possession of a burying place of Ephron the Hittite before Mamre. And verse 13, for his sons carried him. So you have this whole procession that comes up to the threshing floor of Atad, and they weep there for 7 days. And then it seems like the sons separate from this whole bigger procession, and they actually carry him to the cave of Machpelah and bury him there. And it's interesting that previously divided brothers had come together to bury their father. So Isaac and Ishmael get together to bury Abraham, and Isaac and Jacob and Esau had gotten together to bury Isaac. And now all 12 of the brothers get together and they go and bury their father. In verse 14, and Joseph returned into Egypt, he and his brethren and all that went up with him to bury his father after he had buried his father. So fulfilling his promise to Pharaoh, the time for the Exodus had not yet come. Any questions about verses 1 through 14? I know we went over that pretty quickly because I want to focus on the next section. But any questions before you move on? All right. Going once, going twice. Verse 15. And when Joseph's brethren saw that their father was dead, they said, Joseph will peradventure hate us. Perhaps Joseph's going to hate us and will certainly require of us all the evil that we did under him. And when Joseph's brethren saw that their father was dead. Now, obviously, this doesn't mean because they've already gone and they've mourned for him for 70 days at least, and they've gone on a trip to Canaan and come back. So it's not like, oh, wow, it just dawned on them that their father was dead. It's rather when they realized the full significance of what had taken place. So it's not like they didn't know their father was dead till after they had buried him. It's a probably being used idiomatically. When the full significance of what had taken place dawned on them, then they responded in this way. Verse 16. And they sent a messenger unto Joseph, saying, Thy father did command before he died, saying, So shall ye say unto Joseph, Forgive, I pray thee now, the trespass of thy brethren and their sin, for they did unto the evil. And now we pray thee, forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of thy father. So we don't know whether or not this is true. So there's no record that Joseph's brothers had talked to their father about this and that their father had actually said this. So it's left ambiguous whether or not this story had actually taken place. But it seems like Joseph does accept it at face value. And so my judgment would be probably they actually did have this conversation. But it's hard to be sure because the text doesn't tell us one way or the other. And Joseph wept when they spake unto him, second part of verse 17. And his brethren also went and fell down before his face, and they said, Behold, we be thy servants. And there was something that I brought up in Genesis 37, back when we were still doing this in our neighborhood fellowships. I raised some of the ambiguities of Joseph's dreams. And I promised at that point that we were going to return to this when we got to chapter 50 and verse 19, which is where we have now arrived. And so this is really a key verse that affects the whole way that you read the Joseph story as a whole. And so we need to sort of recap and review this whole matter of the dreams in the Joseph story before we go on to the next verse. So as most of you will be aware, having gone through Genesis together, there are three pairs of dreams that are central to the Joseph story. They form the backbone of the story of Joseph. Does anyone want to say which three sets those might be? Go ahead and raise your hand, or you can type it in the comments. Anyone? Has anyone raised their hand,
John? There, Peter, on the chat.
Yeah, so the sheaves and stars. So Joseph has two dreams. Who else has dreams?
The butler and the chef and Pharaoh.
Right. So Joseph has two dreams. The butler and the baker have two dreams. And Pharaoh has two dreams. So you have three pairs of two dreams. Joseph's own dreams in chapter 37, the butler and the baker dream in chapter 40, and Pharaoh dreams in chapter 41. The second set of two dreams receive explicitly divine authorized interpretations in the text of Genesis through Joseph. So the butler and the baker dream, and Joseph interprets their dreams. Pharaoh dreams, and Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dreams. So in the text, it tells us these dreams came from God, and here's what the dreams meant. And though the dreams of the butler and the baker sound very similar, so they sounded very similar, but the outcomes were radically different. So of course, the butler had his position restored, the chief cupbearer, and the baker had his head taken off. So their heads were both lifted up, one to his former position, and the other's head was lifted up off of his shoulders. So they had very different outcomes. Pharaoh's dreams of the wheat stalks and the cattle, they initially sounded like they were talking about different things, and the magicians were interpreting them as though they were two different dreams, but actually it was one dream. They had one meaning. So in the case of the butler and the baker, you have, the text tells us, two different dreams with two different outcomes. In the case of Pharaoh's dream, you have two different dreams that are actually have the same meaning. They have the same outcome. And yet Joseph's dreams receive no authoritative explanation in the text, and they're not said to come from God directly in Genesis 37. As one commentator put it, there's no mention of God in 37, 5 through 11. And so this makes it uncertain whether Joseph's dreams are revelatory or merely the product of his own inflated ego. Clearly, this is how his brothers viewed the dreams, so they simply served to fuel their existing hatred of him. And so we need to go back to Genesis 37 and work through Joseph's dreams. And this has a very close connection to chapter 50 and verse 19, so we're going to get to that in a minute. So Genesis 37 and verse 5, and Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. And lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood round about and made obeisance or bowed down to my sheaf. And his brethren said to him, shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. So the first dream pictures Joseph's brothers bowing down to them, rather bowing down to Joseph. And the sheaf imagery pictures the grain that he would provide for them. As all agree, the rest of the narrative makes clear that this first dream is fulfilled when Joseph's brothers, including Benjamin in the second journey, bow down to him upon their arrival to buy grain from Egypt, Genesis 42:6. And this was indeed of divine origin, and it is fulfilled in every detail. And yet Joseph has a second dream. And he dreamed yet another dream and told it his brethren, and said, behold, I have dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance or bowed down to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren, and his father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth? And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. Well, for a number of reasons, Joseph's second dream is rather more difficult. First, given the precision with which all the other dreams are fulfilled, it's striking that there are a number of points at which this dream can only very loosely be seen to have been fulfilled. So all the details of the butler's dream, the baker's dream, and Pharaoh's dreams are all fulfilled, but the details of this dream are not clearly fulfilled. So Rachel, Joseph's mother, is already dead. So if the moon represents Rachel, she never bows down to Joseph. And in Joseph's final meeting with Jacob, it's Joseph who bows down to the earth before his father, rather than the other way around. Now, there's a place in 47 where Jacob bows on the bed. He like leans on something. So it could be seen that that might be the fulfillment, but there's no clear place where Jacob bows down to Joseph, but there is a clear place where Joseph bows down to his father rather than the other way around. Second, and more seriously, while the imagery of the first dream puts Joseph in the place of an exalted human provider, so you have 12 sheaves, 11 of them bow down to one sheaf, and it's the image of an exalted human provider of grain. The imagery of the second dream seems to put him into the place of God himself. So the imagery of the sun, moon, and stars bowing down to one is elsewhere in the Old Testament only used of the Lord God himself, Psalm 148:3. And it's actually the satanic king of Babylon whose pride causes him to seek exaltation above the stars. So Isaiah 14, it is Satan that wants to be, or the king of Babylon who's being spoken of using the language of the fall of Satan, who desires to exalt himself above the stars. So to exalt yourself above the stars, above the sun, above the moon, is a claim to put oneself in the place of God. And so it's possible to sort of explain away these ambiguities. And that is certainly possible. There are ambiguities that we sometimes don't have a good answer to. But there's another way of taking this, and I'm going to try to explore that and show how it connects to our text tonight. But with Joseph's two dreams, rather than being explained in the narrative itself as the dreams of Pharaoh and his butler and baker have been, we are left to try to figure out the interpretation of, so what do the dreams mean? And how do the two dreams relate to each other? We're left to figure that out from the course of the narrative itself. And what's really important to keep in mind here is that the relationship between the two dreams is central to the interpretation of the other pairs. So when Joseph explains the butler and the baker, it's the relationship between those two dreams that is the center of his explanation. And when Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dreams, the same is the case. It's the relationship between the first and the second dream that the magicians get wrong and Joseph gets right. So there's a precedent set with the other two dreams that the key point that you need to get right is how does the first of the pair and the second of the pair relate to one another? So how are they related? That's the question that's at issue. And there's two different approaches. They could have two dreams with two different outcomes or two dreams with the same outcome. So we have two different examples of that. And while the two dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same, and the dreams of the butler and the baker, though similar, depict radically different outcomes to their lives, I'd like to suggest the two dreams of Joseph seem to present two alternative paths in the life of Joseph himself. So will Joseph be satisfied to be an exalted provider of food, or will he idolatrously put himself into the place of God himself? What kind of person is Joseph going to become? And as we work through the twists and turns of Joseph's interactions with his brothers, this is the burning question. Because we know, having read the story of Joseph and heard it from childhood, we know the outcome of the story. We know what Joseph is going to end up like. But if you're hearing a story for the first time and you're following the story as it's being told, you actually don't know before you read the story how Joseph is ultimately going to treat his brothers. Because some of the ways that he treats them on the face of it certainly seem like he's thinking about pursuing revenge against them. Now, he ultimately doesn't, but simply because we know what he ultimately chose doesn't mean that Joseph knew exactly what he was going to choose. So Joseph had to see his own character develop over the course of the story. And it's only when we get to Genesis 50:19, in the very last chapter of the book, that the question is finally answered as to which of Joseph's dreams will be the final story of his life. And so if we take the two dreams this way, then each pair of dreams gives us a different way of relating the two dreams together. Pharaoh's dreams, two dreams, same point. The butler and the baker, two different people with two different dreams that have two different outcomes. And then with Joseph, we have two different dreams that are alternative paths that Joseph could walk down. Ruth Kinney asks, could that have been a reference to Egypt? I believe the Egyptians had some sort of sun thing going on regarding their Pharaoh. And yes, that actually would be the connection, that you have the path of Pharaoh who thought himself to be a god. And so the idea that would strengthen the case that to be put above the sun would be a sort of self-deifying action. So that would be the connection there. In terms of seeing the dream in a way that it was fulfilled, there's no evidence in the story that, like, Pharaoh, for instance, bows down to Joseph. So it clearly has to do with his family. But the idea of self-exaltation and self-deification was a big issue in Egypt, and so relevant to the options that Joseph had before him. So now we're going to get to how all of this connects to our text tonight, but we had to review that background in order to be able to make this point. So verses 19 through 21, and Joseph said unto them, "Fear not, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good to bring it to pass as it is this day to save much people alive. Now therefore, fear ye not, I will nourish you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spake kindly unto them. Before digging into the details, it's important to note that Joseph here contrasts nourishing and providing for his family. So that was the first dream, with putting himself in the place of God. The second dream, he says, I'm not going to put myself in the place of God, but instead I'm going to provide for you. So we have this, he's going to do one and not going to do the other. He will not put himself into the place of God, but he will nourish them. Fear not, for am I in the place of God? As important as this is for the story of Joseph and his dreams, there's a broader pattern here that we need to see. All the way back in the very first section of Genesis, we find the serpent inviting Eve to put herself in God's place. So if this was the only time that the idea of someone exalting themselves to the place of God showed up in Genesis, then you might be, well, it's not quite clear that's what's going on in the text. But we're coming to the conclusion of Genesis, And it's tying back to the first story in Genesis, because you remember, you have the prologue that tells the story of creation, and then the very first story, the first Toledot, the first generation's heading in Genesis, tells the story of the fall of mankind. Genesis 3:5, "For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods." And in Hebrew, that could just as well be, "Ye shall be as God, the true God." That would be the same, because, well, I won't get into the grammatical technicalities here tonight. "Knowing good and evil. For Eve to take it upon herself to determine for herself the difference between good and evil was to put herself in the place of God, to attempt to become God's equal." And this is exactly what Joseph repudiates in this verse. He will not take it upon himself to exact vengeance on his brothers, because vengeance belongs unto the Lord. Paul made that clear in Romans, quoting from Deuteronomy. As one commentator put it, Genesis begins by telling us about a primeval couple who tried to become like God, and ends by telling us about a man who denied he was in God's place. Adam and Eve attempted to wipe out the dividing line between humanity and deity, and Joseph refuses to try to cross that line. Joseph will only be God's instrument, never his substitute. And if you read the two dreams in the way that I suggested that we should read them, and things like that are difficult to prove, but if we do read those two dreams in that way, then that fits perfectly with an overall theme that connects the end of Genesis with the beginning of Genesis, and I think illuminates the whole story of Joseph from the beginning of Joseph's story to the end of Joseph's story. Now, I have an application question at this point, but before we move on to the application question, are there any questions about the overall interpretation of the dreams and all sort of the material that we covered up to this point before we move on to doing an application question? So any questions about the content, interpretation, the passages, or comments on that before we move on to application?
Is it better just to unmute or type it? What do you guys prefer?
Unmute first. Go for it.
So I was trying to figure this out, where you said that there's no record of the conversation, but in Genesis 49:29, it says that he charged them and said unto them, it just feels like maybe that's the record of the conversation. And he charged them and said unto them, "I am to be gathered unto my people." And he's just talking about where he's supposed to be buried, where the cave is. And I know that the cave was like a big family burial cave, as far as I understand. So I don't know. It sounded weird where you're like, there's no record of that. And so that kind of caught my attention.
Okay. So maybe I wasn't clear. There's no record of him giving instructions for what to do with Joseph after he died. So he repeatedly told them, "Bury me in the land of Canaan." So both Joseph individually and the brothers, but there's no record of him saying, "When I die, here's how you keep Joseph from killing you."
Right. So that part could have been just them coming together, like, "Hey, we got to protect ourselves. How are we going to plead with them?"
Right. Okay. Right. So that's where that's ambiguous, because Joseph would have been present there in 49. So it can't have been then. So it's left open. Was there some other time where he got all the brothers together apart from Joseph to tell them, "Now Joseph might want to kill you when I'm gone. So here's what you do for that." That's what, you know, so the instructions on his burial, absolutely, there's a record of that. And that's one of the records that you pointed out. And then earlier in chapter 47, he speaks to Joseph alone as well on that. It's just their speech about your father, your father told us, here's how you deal with Joseph when I'm gone. That's what's ambiguous. Christy Tanaka commented, "Do you think that Joseph's first dream came to pass since his brothers did bow down to them? If these dreams weren't from God, do you think Joseph might have made them up?" So certainly Joseph's first dream is interpreted, but I think the question is, it's not said they're not from God. It's simply left open, and the story then, so it's an open question. So as we read Genesis 37, it doesn't tell us where these dreams came from. So we're left to figure it out from the story. And I think what's actually taking place is Joseph's wisdom in the story, in interpreting the dream, is being able to figure out how these two dreams are related to one another. That's how Joseph demonstrates his wisdom. And I think in leaving it open, the text is inviting us to learn to be like Joseph and decide and see how to interpret Joseph's dream. So it's leading us in the path of wisdom to try to follow Joseph's example by interpreting his dreams. Though, of course, we don't have Joseph's wisdom, so our answers are going to be potentially a little less certain than Joseph's interpretation of Pharaoh's dream. But I don't think him making them up, but there's, you know, dreams can also come from what we're thinking about. And it could be, you know, so if the second, you know, it could be that these are even dreams that could have come from God, but rather than presenting this is going to happen and this is going to happen, it could be you're either going to take this approach to life and have this outcome or this approach to life and have this outcome. And that would be a way of saying, hey, they were in some sense a revelatory, but rather than being, you know, A, it's going to happen and then B is going to happen, it could be here are two possible paths for Joseph's life to take. And then the reader is left to figure out which of them he actually does take. And it's at the very end that we see that contrast that we've been left wondering, how are these dreams fulfilled? How do these things connect? And I think 50:19 through 21, you know, as you'd suspect at the very end of the story, is what sort of gives the missing key that you stick in the lock and you're like, oh, that's what was taking place at the beginning of the Joseph story. And at the same time, it connects back to the beginning of Genesis. So it's like, you know, you stick the key in the lock and the first lock opens, and then the opening of the first lock opens a whole series of sort of Russian dolls, and it ties the whole book together in one fell swoop. Any other questions or comments on that before we move on to application? So the application question, I'm going to go ahead.
I've got it.
Oh, you got it. Great. What are some of the ways in which we might be tempted to put ourselves into the place of God? So some examples would be using the authority God has given us to lord over others instead of serving them. So this could be a temptation to husbands, parents, or employers, seeking vengeance for the wrongs that have been done to us, etc. So what are some of the ways in which we might be tempted to put ourselves into the place of God? Anyone? Going once. Putting ourselves to be the ultimate judge. Dismissing sin under the guise that we are under grace. I think both of those two things tie to, Christy Tanaka commented, silent anger or avoiding someone. All of those things have a common theme, and that's putting ourselves up as the judge and the jury that gets to condemn other people and say, well, I'm the one who gets to determine between what's right and what's wrong, and to determine the appropriate consequence for that as well, because I'm the judge and everyone else stands beneath me and I lay down the law, turning yourself into a lawgiver. Lucas commented, not waiting on God in an evil situation. Something bad happens to us and we choose to develop our own way or thoughts rather than to be patient and waiting on God to have his perfect will. And so we determine how to get ourselves out of the situation without taking guidance from the word of God. We take matters into our own hands, you know, which is exactly what Joseph did not do. He did not take matters into his own hands, though he certainly could have been tempted to do so, but ultimately he left it up to God. And he recognized that at the end of the story, God had brought good out of evil, that evil had been intended, but God had accomplished good. Ashley commented, wow, Jess, insightful. Lucas, thumbs up, because Lucas is showing up as Jess on the comments. Bill Berger commented, our pride, we let it control a lot of how and what we think. That we think of ourselves as being exalted And so Pastor John talked about this, one of his tempted and tried weeks, that when we have a lot of pride, then anyone who attacks, it was last week, anyone who slights us, then they've attacked our God. And so it's not just a criticism, it's blasphemy, because they've attacked what's most important to us, namely ourselves. And so we respond in an extreme way because of that. And it's ultimately because of the self-idolatry. We put ourselves in the place of God so that it becomes blasphemy to criticize us. Cindy commented, what about questioning God's sovereignty in a prideful way? Is that a way? Absolutely. You know, where we say, hey, I know better than God. God, I don't, there's a humble way of saying, God, I don't understand. But there's a prideful way of saying, God, you did it wrong. This, you owe it to me to explain to me why you did it that way. And that can be prideful, and that can be exactly this. John Trotter commented, we seek to please man over pleasing God, decidedly not being the servants of Christ, Galatians 1:10. Nate Axtell commented, by putting forth our traditions and preferences as God's commands, which is absolutely a way that this happens, where we decide to speak where God has not spoken and to speak in God's place. Now, it's appropriate to try to apply what we know of God's wisdom to a new situation, but we have to do that as our, this is what I think, not this is what God has said. But when we take what we have said and put it in the place of what God has said, then we're putting ourselves in God's place. Those are all very, very good applications. And we're going to try to move on and get to the end of chapter 50. So still a bit of material to cover. So Genesis 50:22, and Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's house, and Joseph lived 110 years. We talked about the significance of the age of Joseph in a previous week. And it's also potentially significant that 110 years old is widely considered to be the ideal age in Egyptian literature and culture. So there's a lot of references to this in Egyptian writings that have come down, that this is sort of the perfect age to die is at 110. Not a bad idea at all. Verse 23, and Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were brought up on Joseph's knees. So Ephraim's children of the third generation, that could either mean Joseph's great-grandchildren or his great-great-grandchildren, because of the third generation, it's not 100% clear whether that's the third generation after Ephraim or the third generation after Joseph in Ephraim's line. So either of those is possibility, but he saw at least his great-grandchildren, possibly his great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, and then great-grandchildren in Manasseh's line. So it talks about the line of Ephraim, and then it talks about the line of Manasseh. And as the KJV translators note in the margin, brought up on Joseph's knees would literally translate as were born on the knees of Joseph, which it's unlikely that grandson's wife, he was in the delivery room with his grandson's wife. That's probably not what it's talking about. We find the same phrase in earlier in Genesis, Genesis 30 and verse 3. And she said, that's Rachel said, behold, my maid Bilhah, go in under her, and she shall bear upon my knees that I may have children by her. And the meaning here seems to be that Bilhah's children would count as Rachel's. So rather than being a literal phrase, it's an idiom, and what it means is that the children of Bilhah would be reckoned as belonging to Rachel. So essentially, Rachel would be counted as the mother of Bilhah's children, sort of an inner family adoption. The ESV puts this sense this way, the children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were counted as Joseph's own. So it seems to be an idiom, and that seems to be what it means. And so the point is, therefore, that Joseph had the opportunity to adopt his own grandchildren as Jacob had done before him. So that seems to be the point there. And then verses 24 and 25. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land unto the land which he sware to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones from hence. So there are three further references to the bones of Joseph in the scriptures. In Exodus 13:19, as they're ready to do the Exodus, Moses takes the bones of Joseph with him, for he had strictly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones away hence with you. In Joshua 24, you have another reference to the bones of Joseph finally being buried in Shechem. And then in Hebrews 11:22 in the New Testament, by faith, it says, Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. So these bones show up again. Verse 26, so Joseph died being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So the word translated here as coffin appears 201 other times in the Old Testament. And this afternoon, I took a few minutes and looked at all of them. Six times, it's used to refer to a chest for collecting money for the repair of the temple in Kings, and the story is told again in Chronicles. All other times, it's used to refer to the Ark of the Covenant. So it's an entirely different word. The Hebrew word is entirely different from the word that's used to refer to the Ark of Noah or the Ark into which Moses was placed. So there's one word that's used for Moses' basket and Noah's Ark. So those two are connected. And there's one word that's used to refer to the Ark of the Covenant and to the chest into which Joseph's bones are placed. So rather than being a mere coffin, the chest in which Joseph's bones were placed was a physical reminder to the children of Israel that Egypt was not going to be their home forever. It was a reminder that the day would come when God would bring them to the homeland that he had promised. As the Ark of the Covenant would one day be a reminder of the promises of God, so the chest in which Joseph's bones were placed was a reminder of the promises of God. And as the writer to the Hebrews reminds us, the final fulfillment of the giving of a homeland extends far beyond the land of Canaan, but it includes nothing less than the new heavens and the new earth. Hebrews 11:13 and following. These all died in faith, including Joseph, who is in this hall of faith as well, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better country, that is, in heavenly. Wherefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. And the point that the writer to Hebrews is making here is that it's sort of like they looked and they saw the land of Canaan as the land that God had promised. But behind the promise of Canaan and beyond the promise of Canaan, there was a greater promise, the promise of the new heavens and the new earth, the promise of the new Jerusalem that we have depicted for us in the book of Revelation. In other words, our hope is set on the same promise that their hope was set on. Now, there were some things that were going to happen between them and us. So the children of Israel really would go up from Egypt and they would take over the land of Canaan. But the land of Canaan didn't fulfill all the promises of God. There was more, just like David really did become king. But all the promises about David becoming king, David couldn't measure up. He couldn't finally fulfill the hopes that were placed upon him, because the only one who could fulfill those hopes was the true son of the greater son of David, the true and final king, Jesus Christ. And the same is true of the promises regarding the land, that yes, they sought a country. They sought Canaan rather than Egypt. And his bones were put in a coffin to remind his descendants that Egypt was not their home. But ultimately, for the people of God, the earthly Canaan wasn't their home either, because our true home is one we are still waiting on. And like it so often did to God's children in the Old Testament, the day of fulfillment may sometimes seem very far away, as we find in Isaiah, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. Yet though it may seem like we have a long time to wait, the hand of the Lord is not, as Peter reminds us, the Apostle Peter reminds us, slack concerning his promises. For as we find in Habakkuk, for the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. And in the time in between that we now find ourselves, we are called to live in hope, to lay up our bones in coffins, as it were, because we are confident that the day is coming when God's people will no longer be living in Egypt. And between the time when Joseph's bones were put in a chest, were put in an ark in the land of Egypt, and the time when those bones were buried in Shechem, things got a whole lot worse before they got better. But the whole time the children of Israel were living in slavery, they had this chest of bones to look at to remind them that Egypt was not going to be their home forever, that they had a home in Canaan, that the Lord God was going to deliver them and bring them to. And that brings us to our final application question of the book of Genesis. Oh, Josh and I did it at the same time. So there's just one application question there. And while you all are reading that, I'm going to answer Lucas's question. I just wonder how Joseph conquered his anger when he first saw his brothers in line for food. And I think that's one of the things in the story of Joseph, is Joseph is clearly very upset. And there's an open question. Is Joseph going to seek revenge? Because some of the things that he does looks like he's setting himself up to take vengeance on them. He's plotting and putting them in traps. And on the one hand, he's trying to figure out whether they've changed. But on the other hand, it seems like he's sort of leaving open the option that he could take vengeance. And ultimately, he doesn't do that. But before we've read the story, we don't necessarily know how that's going to happen. So let me read the application question. What steps are we taking in the present to remind our children in the future that this present world is not our final home? To examples, laying up our treasure in heaven because we are confident we'll enjoy it more there than here. And refusing to take vengeance on others because we're confident that our day of vindication is coming. And Nate Axtell gave the first response, taking trips to the cemetery, being mindful of death and mindful that death is not the end. That death may be the end of this mortal existence, but those that have gone on before in faith and trust in Jesus will not be there in the grave forever, but there'll come a day when they will rise once again to be with Christ. And we will be reunited with them. Christy Tanaka commented, being generous with your stuff and not being a hoarder. Jesus told us to lay up our treasures in heaven, because if you hoard things on earth, well, I've never seen those hoarder shows, but just hearing about it was enough to let me know that that's not what I want to do. If you hoard stuff on earth, it deteriorates. But if you lay up treasure in heaven, it accumulates. And that's the heart that we should have. Ashley commented, setting our affections on things above. And Braylon commented, serving others, looking out for the interest of others, not just for the interest of yourself. And Ashley commented, talking about the eternal to our little ones and not only the temporal. And Nate commented, junk is bondage. And that's true. Bill Berger commented, current events are a great reminder that anything we have here on earth can be removed or destroyed by those who have no clue, but that our souls cannot be destroyed and our treasure in heaven cannot be taken away. They can't tear down the treasure you have in heaven because they can't get high enough to do that. Living for eternity, Christy commented. These are all wonderful. Anyone else? Recompensing evil for evil? Absolutely. I think that's one of the biggest temptations that we have, especially as there's a lot more evil going around that we're threatened. I've got to get it right now, because if I don't get even now, I'm never going to get even. But really, this is one of the greatest ways that we can testify. Oh, actually, I do believe in the resurrection. There's a message I preached many years ago before I was here. I don't think I preached it here. But Stephen, as he faced the Sanhedrin, he didn't have to seek vindication on earth because he was confident that he would be vindicated on the day of judgment, so he could leave his vindication with God. And that's why he could be calm, his face as the face of an angel, in the face of horrible and dishonest accusations being made against him. He that wins souls is wise. April commented that. And Lucas commented, God says vengeance is his and that their foot shall slip. And Nate said, should the treatment of Joseph's bones and our common hope inform our theology of bodily remains? And I think the answer to that is yes. So it is not sinful to cremate. So it's not like you won't be resurrected if you're cremated or if your body is destroyed or thrown into the ocean or something like that. But there's still something about burial that testifies to the hope of bodily resurrection. And so if it's impossible, whether for financial reasons, for some other reason, to have a formal burial, then it's not sinful to have an alternative, you know, or you might be burned at the stake or something else could happen to your body, right? You're not hindered in terms of resurrection because you're not buried, but having a internment, there's something about the practice of burial that reflects the Christian hope of resurrection. And so whenever and wherever it's possible, I think there is something that points forward to that. The idea of burial being that way of dealing with the dead, because there have been in human history many, many different ways of dealing with dead bodies. So, you know, the ancient Persians who thought the body was bad would leave the bodies out to be eaten by the vultures because they hated the body and thought the body was bad. And so that's a way that would be very antithetical to the Christian hope. So even the idea of burying the body places a value, even the very fact that it's costly and inconvenient to bury a body places a value on bodily existence that many cultures have not placed. And it points forward to the resurrection, I think. So that's a positive thing for sure. Cindy commented, amen, we used that thinking and decided to bury Danny bodily. Thanks for counseling us regarding this issue when he died. Lucas commented, God bless you guys. Thanks for letting me Zoom with you guys. And I think that was a goodbye. And I guess we've come to the end of our time. Any final comments or questions before we wrap it up? I kept saying I was going to try to have these be 45 minutes, but it never worked out. We probably could have split that into two lessons, but I said we were going to finish Genesis 50 tonight, and lo and behold, we have now finished it, and that concludes. We've gotten to the last verse in Genesis, and we're just going to do a recap of the book as a whole 2 weeks from now.